and 6 of everything. The accommodation pack again. Plain white crockery. 6 cups, 6 glasses. Over 60% of the cupboard space was empty. In the fridge was half a carton of milk, which wasn't looking too healthy. It smelled and looked as if it held the cure for HIV. Next to that were some bagels, still in their plastic bag, and half a jar of peanut butter. And that was it. Not exactly Delia Smith, our Sarah. At least I had some cheese and yogurt in mine. The bathroom was between the kitchen and the bedroom. There was no bath, just a shower, sink, and toilet. The room had been left, as if she'd got up normally, done her stuff, and dashed off to work. A dry but used towel lay on the floor next to a laundry bin, which was half full of jeans, underwear, and tights. No sign of a washing machine, but I wasn't really expecting one. Sarah's clothes would go to a dry cleaner's, or to a laundry for a fluff and fold. The bedroom was about 15 by 20 feet, with a walk-in wardrobe, but no other furniture apart from a double bed and a single bedside lamp sitting on the floor. The duvet was thrown to one side, where she'd just woken up and thrown it off. All the bedding was plain white, the same as the walls. There were pillows for 2 people, but only one of them looked slept on. Again, there were no pictures on the walls, and the Venetian blinds on both windows were closed. Either she'd just got up and gone to work, or this was simply how it always was. The walk-in closet had mirrored sliding doors. I pulled them open, expecting the scent of a woman's wardrobe, that slight waft of stale perfume lingering on jackets which have been worn once and are back on their hangers before they find their way to the cleaners. In fact, there was almost no smell at all, which wasn't surprising. The rows and rows of expensive-looking clothes were all in dry cleaners' plastic wrapping, and even her blouses and T-shirts were on hangers. Out of curiosity, I checked a few labels and found Armani, Joseph, and Donna Karen. She was obviously still slumming it. On a shelf above the dresses was the just-as-expensive luggage to match. Nothing seemed to be missing or out of place. In front of me was a small standalone chest, just a white formica thing with about 5 or 6 drawers. One of the drawers was open. I looked inside and found knickers and bras, again all very expensive. All her footwear was arranged on the floor on the right-hand side of the wardrobe, and looking very orderly. Formal, summer, winter, and a pair of trainers. To the left of the wardrobe, and also on the floor, was a shoebox. I bent down and lifted the lid. A Picasso dove greeted me, on top of more old Christmas and birthday cards. Flicking through them, I found a picture of her arm in arm with a tall, good-looking man. They were in Woodland, looking extremely happy, both dressed the part in waterproofs and boots. Maybe this was Jonathan. And presumably, in happier times. Sarah looked a little older than when I'd seen her on the Syria job. The bob had had 3 years to grow out, and her hair was about shoulder length, still very straight, and with a fringe which was just above those big eyes. She hadn't put on weight and still looked fantastic as she smiled that almost innocent, childlike grin towards me. I realized I was looking at the man beside her and wishing it was me, as I dropped the photo back in the box and lay down on the bed. There was no smell of her, just that of dry-cleaned cotton. We had been in and out of Afghanistan those first 2 months with no result. The rebels had managed to get a major offensive off the ground in between their internal feuds, and were kicking the arse out of the Russians. No one would be talking to us for a while, so we got out of the way, taking time off and generally having fun. We could only hope that one of the rebel groups with an entrepreneurial flair would attack a heliport and see us all right with a couple of hinds. Both of us could have gone back to the UK with the other 3 and done our own thing. But she wanted to go trekking in Nepal, and I knew the country well. It seemed a simple swap. She showed me the historical and religious sites, and I showed her the bars and dives where, as a young infantry soldier on an exchange with the Gurkhas, I had been separated from my money. It was an education for both of us. It was during the first week off, staying in Kathmandu, before moving to Pokhara for our week's trek, that things changed. By now, she would take the piss out of my accent. I called Hackney, Acne, and she called it Hackney. We'd just finished a run one day, and were both getting our keycards from our socks, when she leaned into my ear and said in her bad Cockney accent, "All right, darling. You want to fuck or what?" 3 weeks later, and back with the rest of the team in Pakistan, the cover story of being a couple was now played out for real. I even had fantasies of maybe seeing her later on once the job had ended. I'd been married for 4 years and things hadn't been going well. Now, they were in shit state. With Sarah, I enjoyed the intimate talks and learning about things I'd never bothered to find out about, or even knew existed. Up until then, I'd thought Cozy Van Tutti was an Italian ice cream. This was it. Love. I didn't understand what was happening to me. For the first time in my life, I had deep, loving feelings for someone. Even better, I got the impression she felt the same. I couldn't bring myself to ask her, though. The fear of rejection was just too great. When the Afghanistan job finished, we were on the flight home from Delhi and well into our descent to Heathrow before I plucked up enough courage to ask her the big question. I still didn't know that much about her, but it didn't matter. I didn't think she knew that much about me either. I just really needed to be with her. I felt like a child being dropped off by a parent and not knowing if they will ever come back. Courage or desperation? I wasn't sure which, but I kept my eyes on the in-flight magazine and said, very throwaway, "We're still going to see each other, aren't we?" The dread of rejection lifted as she said, "Of course." Then she added, "We've got to debrief." I thought she'd misunderstood me. No, I hoped later on we might be able to see each other. You know, out of work. Sarah looked at me, and I saw her jaw drop a fraction in disbelief. She said, "I don't think so. Do you?" She must have seen the confusion on my face. "Come on, Nick. It's not as if we're in love with each other or anything like that. We spent a lot of time together, and it was great." I couldn't bear to look at her, so I just kept my eyes fixed on the page. Fuck. I'd never felt so crushed. It was like going to the doctor for a routine checkup and being told I was going to have a slow, painful death. "Look, Nick." There wasn't a hint of regret in her voice. "We had a job to do, and it was a success. That means it was a success for both of us. You got what you wanted out of it, and so did I." She paused. "Look, the more intimate we were, the more you would protect me, right? Am I right?" I nodded. She was right. I would probably have died for her. Before she could say another word, I did what had always worked in the past, ever since childhood. I just cut away. I looked at her as if I'd just been asking her out for a drink and said, "Oh, okay. Just thought I'd ask." I'd never been fucked off with such casual finesse. I kicked myself for even having considered that she would want to be with me. Just who the fuck did I think I was? I was definitely suffering from the dreamer's disease. It was only a month after we'd landed at Heathrow that I left my wife. We were just existing together. and it didn't seem right to be sleeping with her and thinking of Sarah. When the Syria job came along, I didn't know she was going to be on it. We met for orders in London, this time in better offices. Vauxhall Cross, the new home of SIS, overlooking the Thames. She acted as if nothing had ever happened between us. Maybe it hadn't for her. But it had for me. I made a plan. Never again would she or any other woman fuck me over. I sat up on the bed and put the lid on the shoebox. That could wait. I needed to tune into this place and try to get a feel of it. I went back into the kitchen, filled the coffee percolator with water and ground beans and got it going. Then I went back into the living room. Sperm bank, or the sperm, as I now like to call them, were still rattling along big time. I slumped sideways in one of the chairs, with my back against one arm, my legs over the other. I'd found nothing at all on the first sweep. I would have to give each room a thorough going over, digging everything out. Somewhere, somehow, there could be a slight clue, a tiny hint. Maybe. The only thing I knew for sure was that if I rushed it, I wouldn't find anything. As I looked around me, my thoughts drifted. Sarah wasn't that different from me, really. Everything in my life was disposable, from a toothbrush to a car. I didn't have a single possession that was more than 2 years old. I bought clothes for a job and threw them away once they were dirty, leaving hundreds of pounds worth of whatever behind me because I didn't need it anymore. At least she had a photo. I didn't have any mementos of family, school days, or the army, not even of Kelly and me. It was something I was always going to get around to, but hadn't. I went back to the kitchen, realizing I was thinking more about myself than her. And I wasn't looking for me. I was starting to feel quite depressed. This was going to be a long, long job. But I had to do it by the book if it was going to work. I poured myself a cup of coffee and went to the fridge, then remembered that the milk was only good for medical research. I couldn't find powdered creamer, so I'd have to have it black. I took the pot with me, and was walking back into the living room just as the sperm decided to sign off. I threw myself back in one of the chairs and put my feet up again on the coffee table, sipping the hot coffee and thinking, I've got to make a start. It'll be like most things. Once you get stuck in, everything's fine. I finished the first coffee, poured another, got up and wandered over to the sideboard. I plonked the cup next to the CDs, then started to take off my Timberlands. I'd worn boots like this for years. They always seemed the thing to wear with jeans, and I always wore jeans. It felt like I hadn't taken them off for days, and it was time to let my feet and socks add to the apartment's atmosphere. To work, then. Starting from the top, I opened the first drawer and took out a sheaf of dry cleaning receipts, theatre stubs, and folded up back copies of Time. I studied each item in turn, opening each page of every magazine to check nothing had been ripped out, scored or ringed. Had I found anything missing, I'd have had to go to a reference library and get hold of the issue to find out what was so interesting that it had been removed. But there was nothing like that. The second drawer was much the same, just as full of shit. The other drawers were completely empty, apart from one solitary safety pin, still stuck into yet another dry cleaning ticket. I was becoming bored, pissed off, and very hungry. It was nearing time for my first Mickey D's of the trip. I'd just heard on the radio that McDonald's mission statement for the USA was something like that no American was ever more than 6 minutes away from a Big Mac. In the UK, that would make most heroin addicts jump for joy. Scales were old hat for measuring out deals. McDonald's 100 milligram spoons were absolutely perfect. Before I went to fill my face, however, I decided to give the bookshelves the once-over. I took out each book in turn, doing exactly the same as with the magazines. I got quite excited at one stage because a book on political terrorism had passages which had been underlined in pencil and notes in the margin. Until I looked inside the cover and discovered it was a textbook from her university days. It took about an hour, but I eventually got to the bottom shelf. Turning the pages of a photo history of North Carolina, I admired the tree-covered mountains, lakes and wildlife, with bullshit blurb in the accompanying captions. Deer drink contentedly from the pool, next to families enjoying the wonders of the great outdoors. I could almost hear Kelly groaning a, "Yeah, right." I took a look at her other books, about Algeria, Syria and the Lebanon, but they contain nothing but photograph upon photograph of mosques, cypress trees, sand and camels. I threw them on the floor to check through later and started flicking through the atlas. Then I had second thoughts, deciding to go back to the chair with the atlas and the other three books and do the lot now. As I started a careful page-by-page check, I found my attention drifting to the traffic in the street below, which I could just about hear through the double glazing. But it wasn't just my hearing that was wandering. For some reason, my mind kept going back to the book about North Carolina. It usually pays to listen to that inner voice. I stopped looking at the books and just stared at the wall, trying to work out what it was that I was trying to say to myself. When I thought I understood it, I got up and went into her bedroom. I picked up the shoebox and tipped the contents out onto the bed. When I'd found what I was looking for, it was back to the living room. Turning the pages of the North Carolina book, I tried to match the photograph with the terrain, the type of trees, the background hills, the lakeside. Nothing. The spark was soon put out. It might not necessarily have meant anything, but it might have been a start. My head was starting to hurt. It was time for that burger. I'd be back in an hour to start again. I went to my boots and pushed my feet in, tucking the laces inside, too idle to do them up. 2 minutes later, I was standing waiting for the elevator, staring at my boots, when it hit me. I ran back to the apartment door, opened up and headed for her dressing room. Sarah must have been the Imelda Marcos of the Washington section. She must have had about 30 pairs of shoes in all, but there were no hiking boots. All the times I'd been with her, she had always worn them when out on the ground. Like me, when it came to footwear, she was a creature of habit. I was starting to get sparked up again. I turned and checked the rails. Where was the Gore-Tex jacket? Where was the fleece liner? She had always worn that sort of clothing, and she had it on in the photograph. It wasn't so much what I saw as what I didn't. Her outdoor clothing, it wasn't here. I couldn't go to McDonald's. I had to keep thinking about this. I went into the kitchen and threw some noodles into a pan, filled it up with water and got it boiling on the stove. I realized that was what had been bugging me. I'd known it all along but hadn't switched on, and the ironic thing was that it was Sarah who'd taught me. She was in the middle of one of her very heated, noisy meetings. We'd been stuck in a cave for hours, the smoke from a large fire stinging my eyes and casting dark shadows in the background, just where I wanted to see the most. Two mujahideen were sitting cross-legged on the floor, wrapped in blankets and cradling their AKs. I'd never seen them at other meetings before, and they seemed out of place amongst the other three members of their group who were by the fire. Sarah was also sitting on the floor, draped in blankets beside the fire with the other three Muj. They were all drinking coffee as Sarah got more sparked up with them. The two men in the shadow started muttering between themselves and looking agitated, and eventually they pushed off their blankets and grasped their weapons. In a situation like that, there are only seconds in which to make a decision to go for it or not. I did. I put my AK into the aim, as I stood over Sarah. The result was a Mexican standoff, like something out of a spaghetti western. For 2 or 3 seconds, all that could be heard was the crackling of the fire. Sarah cut the silence. "Nick, sit down. You're embarrassing me." I was very confused as she talked to all the Mujahideen. She sounded like a parent apologizing for her toddler's behavior in the playground. Everyone looked at me and started to laugh, as if I was some sort of schoolboy who'd got it all wrong. All weapons were dropped, and the talking continued. Even the two boys sitting at the back looked on me as some sort of mascot. I was expecting them to come over and ruffle my hair at any moment. It was only when we were on our way back to Pakistan that she explained.
"There was no danger, Nick. The old guy, the one we saw last month."
She smiled as she thought about the event.
"He is the only one with the power to have me killed. And he wasn't there. Those guys at the back were just showing face. Nothing was going to happen."
She sounded like teacher as she added,
"It's not only what you see, Nick. Sometimes what isn't there is just as important as what is."
She might have been right that time, but in a similar situation I would still have done the same. Shame for her that she hadn't remembered her own lesson. I sat down to work out what I wanted to say to Mickey, and the way to say it. I'd already forgotten where I'd put his card, so I got out the 3C, tapped in his name, and rang his number.
"Hello?"
He was eating by the sound of it. "Hello, mate, it's Nick."
"Oh, so soon?"
He sounded quite surprised. I could hear soft rock in the background, and an American voice, just as camp as his, inquiring who was on the phone. His voice became distant.
"Gary, go and do something useful in the kitchen. It's the office."
Gary, it seemed, took the hint.
"Sorry about that. He is so nosy."
I could hear drink being poured and a sip being taken. "Michael, remember what you were saying about Sarah and Jonathan going to the middle of nowhere?"
"Uh-huh."
"Can you remember exactly where it was? I need it for the report." He took a quick swallow.
"Yes, Falls Lake."
He broke into a terrible southern accent.
"North Carolina, y'all."
"Do you have an address or the contact number? You did say that you had a number, remember? You used it to call her." He laughed.
"Sarah took it off fire when old Johnny boy got his comeuppance."
I had reached another dead end. Then he added,
"But I think I can remember most of the number. It was almost the same as my mother's old one. Tell you what, give me 5 and I'll ring you back, okay?"
"Give it 3 rings. Put down, then ring again. I wouldn't want to pick it up and find I'm talking to her mother or anything like that, okay?"
"Ooh, just like James Bond," he giggled. "No problem, Nick. Talk soon. Bye."
I flicked through the book again. Falls Lake did exist, but it covered a vast area.
What a dickhead.
Why hadn't I asked him for more detail when he told me the story? Just as well I wasn't in a security cell. Something was smelling bad. I jumped up and ran into the kitchen. The hot water had boiled away and I pulled a pan of very hot and smelly black noodles from the stove. I couldn't be asked to clean it up. Just put the pot to one side and turned the cooker off. The phone rang. I walked back into the room, counting. It stopped after 3. Good news, I hoped. I let the new call ring twice before picking it up.
"Hello, Michael here."
I could hear Gary singing to himself in the background.
Hello, mate. Any luck? The last four digits are exactly the same as my mother's old number in Mill Hill. Isn't that freaky?
I really didn't have an answer for that. I contained my eagerness.
Oh. And what was it?
4468.
Thanks, mate. You sure that's all you know?
Afraid so, Nick. I was just given the contact number, sorry.
No problem. I'll let you get on with your evening.
Okay, I'm here if you need me. Bye.
I looked at my watch. It was about 9:30. According to my body clock, 2:30 a.m. And I was starting to feel knackered. In the absence of any noodles, it was soon going to be time to RV with Ronald McDonald. But first, I had a phone call to make. I rang a London number. A very clear female voice answered immediately.
PIN number, please.
The tone was so precise, she sounded like the speaking clock. 2442, Charlie Charlie.
Please wait.
The line went dead. 5 seconds later, the voice was back.
Charlie Charlie, details, please.
I gave her the same details as Metal Mickey had given me and asked for the address. I could hear the clinking of keys as she entered the details. She checked with me.
To confirm, North Carolina, address that ends with call number 4468, perhaps in the vicinity of Falls Lake. It should take approximately 30 minutes. Reference 5656. Goodbye.
Charlie Charlie stands for casual contact. The people in London can work from even the smallest amount of information, and you can inquire via the phone for speed, or ask for a written report, which would give more detail but take longer. A phone number or car license plate can lead to you finding out almost everything there is on record about the contact, from the name of his doctor to the last time and place he used his credit card, and what it was he bought. A Charlie Charlie was about the only perk of the job. I'd used it a few times when trying to find out about women I wanted to take out. No one ever asks what you want the information for, and it makes life easier if you know in advance what sort of social life they have. Whether they're married, divorced with kids, or have a monthly champagne bill the size of an average mortgage. All I needed this time was an address. These sorts of requests were routine and wouldn't mean I had gone against Lynn's need-to-know policy. I walked downstairs. I couldn't see Wayne anywhere. I got to the car, took the parking ticket off the windscreen and threw it in the back. I was committed west, towards Georgetown, on the one-way system. That was fine. And in fact, McDonald's were right. Within 5 minutes, I passed the big yellow arches. The only problem was that I couldn't park up anywhere. I decided to cruise on M until I found an easier place to stop. Dead on 30 minutes later, I called London. The speaking clock was back.
Reference, please.
Reference 3214. There was a gap as the line went dead. She was checking the reference number I'd just given her. All I had to do was subtract my PIN from her reference number. It's a quick and easy confirmation system for low-level inquiries. She came back online.
I have three addresses. One.
The first two locations were nowhere near Falls Lake. One was in Charlotte, another in Columbia. The next one sounded warmer.
The Lodge, Little Lick Creek, Falls Lake. This is now a disconnected line. Do you want the zip codes and usernames on any of these?
No, that's fine. Thank you. That's all. I hung up. I didn't care who the disconnected line used to belong to. It wouldn't help me one bit. As I drove, I couldn't get Falls Lake out of my head. I passed a Barnes & Noble bookshop, its neon window sign telling me it was open and selling coffee until 11 p.m. I drove on. A 7-Eleven came to my rescue with a sandwich and coffee. I turned the car round and passed the Barnes & Noble again while filling my face. I couldn't resist it. I parked up, ditched the coffee and finished off the chicken sandwich as I fed another meter. I went straight to the reference section and pulled out a small-scale atlas of North Carolina. I found Falls Lake and Little Lick Creek. It sounded like a commune for oral sex fans. North Carolina was only a short flight away. I could get down there maybe tonight, and if it turned out to be a fuck-up, I'd be back by tomorrow night. I got out my phone and started to make some inquiries. I drove back to the apartment with a ticket for the 0700 from Dulles. I would still check out her bedroom and kitchen, though. Just in case. Chapter 7. I took the slip road off Airport Boulevard, following the signs for Interstate 40. According to the map, if I kept on this highway heading east, I would hit the Cliff Benson Beltline, which would take me north through Raleigh and onto the lake. The weather was a lot warmer here than in D.C., and the clouds were dark and brooding, almost tropical. It had been raining quite heavily by the look of the large puddles that lined the road, and the sandy soil was dark with moisture. The whole area was going through a massive rebuild. The airport itself had been having a makeover, and a new highway not yet on the map was under construction. On each side of me as I drove east, yellow bulldozers were going apeshit, flattening everything in sight to make way for the steel skeletons of yet more buildings. From reading the local information magazine on the flight, I knew that the area was fast becoming Science City, USA, with the largest concentration of biochemical, computer and technical research establishments and PhDs per capita in the entire USA. It's amazing the stuff you'll read when you're bored shitless on a plane. Rows of pristine, glistening black or silver glass-fronted buildings sat in acres of manicured gardens with lakes and fountains. Not at all what I had in mind for the American South after all the redneck jokes I'd heard over the years. It took about 15 minutes to get onto the Beltline. I drive clockwise heading north around the city, keeping my eyes peeled for signs for exit 10 towards Falls Lake. The new money that this transformation had sucked in was impossible to miss, with grand houses and new business fighting hand to hand with the old and demonstrably winning. Smart new office blocks looked down on decrepit trailer parks strewn with abandoned cars and kids, both black and white, whose arses hung out of their dirty jeans, their parents fucked without the skills needed to take advantage of the new opportunity. I got to exit 10 in another 10 minutes or so, and headed north on Forest Road. From the map, I knew that the Falls Lake area covered about 200 square miles. It was a very long and winding waterway with hundreds of inlets, like the coastline of Norway, just the kind of place you could disappear into. After 7 miles, the road became a single carriageway. Tall firs interspersed with smaller seasonal trees looming on either side. 4 more miles, and I reached the Falls of Neuse, and entered Forest proper. The Falls was a small collection of neat little homes made of natural wood or painted white on the eastern side of the lake area. Even here, the new was winning out over the old and rubbing its nose in it. Tracts of land were being carved out of the woods to make way for communities of enormous mansions to house the middle classes who were streaming in for the new gold rush of high-tech jobs. At the entry point into each community was a twee, shiny sign announcing carriageways or fairways, and at each junction a barrage of estate agents' signs directed buyers to even more land which was up for grabs. I headed west on Raven Ridge, driving deeper into the forest. The new was gradually less and less evident, until it was the old that prevailed once more. Dilapidated shacks with car wrecks for garden furniture, and run-down stores built of bare breeze block,
with peeling signs advertising bait and beer. I passed trailer homes that looked as if they'd just been dumped 20 or 30 metres off the road, with no paved access, just trampled ground. And no fences to mark their territory, just corrugated iron leaning around the bottom of the trailers to make them look as if they belonged. Outside, washing hung on lines getting even wetter. Inside, probably, were the stars of the Ricky Lake or Jerry Springer shows. Fuck knows what the future held for them. But one thing was for sure, new carriageways would be scything through here within a year or two. The only buildings that weren't falling down or apart were the churches, of which there seemed to be one every mile along the roadside, standing very clean, bright and white. Each projected a different recruiting message on the sort of signboard that cinemas used to advertise their movies. "You can't even write Christmas without Christ," one said. Which was true, but strange to see in April. Maybe they liked to think ahead. I drove for another 20 minutes past trailers and churches, and now and then the occasional neatly tended graveyard right on the side of the road. I came across a small green sign to Little Lick Creek. It wasn't the creek itself I was after, but the point at which it entered the lake, and where one of the spurs had the same name. Going by the waterproof hunting map I'd bought, there were two buildings in that area which weren't accounted for by a symbol on the map legend, so they were probably private houses. I turned off the tarmac and headed down a gravel road that was just wide enough for two cars to pass. There was a steep gradient each side, and the forest seemed to be closing in. The trees here even higher and more densely packed. A sign chiselled into a slab of grey-painted wood warned, "Firearms strictly prohibited." 50 metres further on, another said, "No alcoholic beverages." Soon, more friendly signs welcomed me to Falls Lake, and directed me to the car parks and recreational areas and hoped I enjoyed myself, but only if I kept my speed to 25 miles per hour. Up ahead, a motorhome as big as a juggernaut was bearing down on me. I noticed a small track that obviously took wheeled traffic, because there were tire grooves worn down on each side of a wet, grassy central strip. But I didn't have time to get in there. I slowed and pulled over to the side of the road, my car leaning drunkenly to the right. The Winnebago was a massive vehicle, with enough canoes and mountain bikes strapped onto its exterior to equip the US Olympic team, and the family hatchback towed along behind. A wall of spray splashed onto my windscreen as it passed. I didn't even get a wave of acknowledgement. I drove for another kilometre or so through the forest before I came to a large car park. Crunching and squelching across a mixture of gravel and mud, I pulled up next to a big map in a wooden frame. Pictures around the edge displayed various indigenous birds, turtles, trees and plants, as well as the tariff for the campsite and the inevitable, "Enjoy your stay. Take only pictures, leave only footprints." It was possible that I would be taking pictures, but I hoped I would leave no footprints whatsoever. Driving on for another 100 metres or so, I caught my first glimpse of Little Lick Creek. It wasn't quite the picture postcard scene I'd been expecting. Tall ranks of firs seemed to have marched right to the lake's edge. The water was smooth and as dark as the clouds it mirrored, like the smoked glass of a Raleigh office block. Maybe when the sun was out the area was idyllic, but just now, especially with the trees so claustrophobically close to the water, the atmosphere was more like the brooding menace of a penitentiary. Over on the other side, 500 metres away and on higher, more undulating ground, sat two houses. They were the ones I wanted to have a look at. A dozen or so vehicles were already in the car park, mostly clustered around a wooden boat shed on the lake's edge, which had been designed to look like a fort. Canoes and rowing boats were lined up near it in the water, plus the statutory Coke machine, and another selling chocolate bars. I'd watched a documentary once, which claimed that the Coca-Cola Company was so powerful in the US that it had even got a president into power in the 1960s. I wondered how their mission statement compared with Ronald McDonald's. It certainly seems that no matter where you are in the world, you will always be able to get a Coke. I'd even been offered one by a 6-year-old on a mountainside in Nepal. Out trekking with Sarah in the middle of nowhere, a kid no older than 8 came along the track with a tin bucket filled with water and about 6 battered cans of Coke inside, trying to sell them to the walkers as they made their way up the mountain. Sarah gave him some money but refused the Coke. She had this hang-up about cultures being contaminated by the West and spent the next hour bumping her gums about it. Me? I was thirsty and just wished he'd had diet instead of regular. As I drove past the fort, I could see that it was manned by 2 young lads lounging in the shadows, who didn't look as if they were coming out unless they had to. At the far end of the car park was a picnic area with built-in grills and a wooden canopy covering the seating. A family barbecue was underway, a bit early in the season, but they were having fun anyway. Granny and Grandad, sons, daughters and grandchildren all filling their faces. Beyond it, I could see the tops of brightly coloured family-sized tents. It looked as if each pitch was surrounded by its own individual little coppice. I turned the car through 180, so I was facing back the way I'd come, and drove towards the toilet block. I nosy parked between 2 other cars, front against the toilet block wall, back to the lake. Picking up the binos and bird book I'd bought at the tourist shop along with my maps, I got out of the car and locked up. Straight away I was hit by the humidity. Having air conditioning in a car almost makes you forget the reason you've turned it on in the first place. Everyone seemed to be having a giggle in the barbecue area. A boombox was playing some Latino rap, and even Granny was dancing rapper style with the kids. In the car to my right were a couple of senior citizens who'd no doubt driven for hours to get here, parked up at the lake, and stayed in the car to eat sandwiches with the air conditioning going full blast and their hats still on. I wandered down towards the boat shed, keeping an eye on the spur at the other side of the creek. The larger house of the two was on the left, with a gap of maybe 100 to 120 metres between them. There was no movement around either. I went to the Coke machine and threw in a handful of coins. I didn't really want to drink, certainly not at a dollar a go. But it gave me a chance to look around. The 2 teenage lads were probably doing a school vacation job. I didn't know whether they were stoned or just bored shitless. Both were barefoot but wearing the company uniform, blue shorts and red polo shirt. I nodded at them through the small swing doors they'd obviously been told to be pleasant and said they hoped I had a nice day. I wasn't sure that I would. I sat down on the wooden jetty and immediately felt the dampness soak into my jeans. To my right were a father and son, with Dad trying to get his boys sparked up about fishing.
"We'll only catch something if you sit very still and watch the float."
The kid, in his Disney poncho, was as uninterested as the 2 in the boat shed. As you would be, if you'd much rather be eating ice cream and playing computer games. I was very overtly carrying the binoculars and bird book. Today, I was the dickhead tourist with his feet dangling over the side of the jetty, taking in the magnificent view over the water. 6 boats were moored at various points around the lake. Through the binoculars, I could see that each one held 2 or 3 very fat, middle-aged men who were dressed for trapping bears in the Yukon, their hunting waistcoats festooned with fishing flies, their pockets bulging with all sorts of kit, and fearsome knives hanging in sheaths from their belts. I panned with the binos along the opposite side of the spur,
starting from the far right-hand side. I made out a track, cutting through the trees just short of the lake on the higher ground, the one I'd stopped by to let the motorhome past. It looked as if it should lead to the houses. I followed it along, and sure enough, it passed the smaller of the two. I couldn't see anything about the building that gave me any information. It was just a square, two-story, flat-roofed structure, built into the hill and with stilts holding the forward two-thirds. There was a boat and a 4x4 vehicle underneath the stilted area, but no movement. Then, two kids came running round from the front of the house, followed by a man. They were laughing and throwing a football at each other. Happy families. I'd give that one a miss. I put the binos down for a while and had a look at the book. This part is all about third-party awareness, because you never know who is looking at you. They might not be saying, "Is he doing a recce of those houses over there?" But if all I did was bino at the house and didn't move or do other things, it would look pretty strange. The trick is to give the impression that whatever reason you have for being there is so straightforward, no one gives you a second glance. I just hoped a fellow anorak didn't come up to me and start on some serious bird talk. I put the book down, much more intimately acquainted with the lesser spotted something or other, and started to look at the other target. By now, enough humidity had condensed on my head for droplets to run down my face, and I was starting to feel sticky and damp all over. The second house was very much like the first, but about a third bigger and with an extra floor. It too was wooden and had a flat, felted roof, but its stilted area had been enclosed with plywood sheeting. Two large doors opened onto a concrete slipway which led down to the water's edge. A boat, a four-seater fiberglass job, ideal for fishing, was parked on the land, still on its trailer, nose facing down towards the water, the outboard engine towards the house. All the curtains seemed to be closed. I couldn't see any rubbish bags outside, or towels or anything else which might indicate that the house was occupied. However, the garage doors were only three-quarters closed, and the rear of a black 4x4 was protruding, which made me think that maybe there was another one inside. I heard a groan from the two boys in red polo shirts. A man was coming towards the fort with three kids, all highly excited about hiring a canoe and already fighting about who was going to have the paddle. I put the binos down and had a swig of Coke, which was now warm and horrible, like the weather. I binned it and got another one. Then I took a walk back to the car. The rave at the picnic area was still going strong. The kids were dancing, and the adults, beer cans in hand around the barbecue, despite the signs forbidding alcohol, were putting the world to rights. Even from this distance, I could hear the loud sizzle as steaks the size of dustbin lids were dropped onto the smoking griddles. The old couple was still in their car, her struggling to drink a can of Dr. Pepper through her false teeth, him reading the inside pages of a newspaper. Nice day out. I could read the headline, even through the windscreen. It looked as though I'd been right. The black convoy that had held me up in D.C. must have been carrying either Netanyahu or Arafat, because both boys were being welcomed to America. I got back to the car and slowly rolled out along the gravel road to the main drag, turning left, back towards the Falls of Neuse and the Beltline. I didn't follow the signs back to Raleigh, though. This time, I wanted the road to Fayetteville. Chapter 8 Fayette-Nam, as some people in the States call it, due to its high casualty rate, is the home of the 82nd Airborne and U.S. Special Forces. They were stationed at Fort Bragg, the only place I knew in North Carolina. About an hour south of Raleigh, or so they told me at the gas station.
I'd first gone there in the mid-1980s for a joint exercise training with Delta Force, the regiment's American counterpart. Deltex was designed to further an atmosphere of cooperation between the two units. But all it did for me was induce huge amounts of envy. I could still remember being bowled over by the sheer size of the place. You could have fitted the entire town of Hereford twice over into what they called a fort. The quantity and quality of equipment on show was beyond belief. Delta had indoor 7.62 and 5.56 shooting ranges. At Sterling Lines, we only had the 9mm equivalent. We also had only one gym. Well, they had dozens of them, including jacuzzis, saunas, and a massive climbing wall for their mountain troop. No wonder we renamed the place Fort Brass. They had more helicopters in one unit than we had in the whole of the British Army. Come to that, there were more personnel in just that one base than in all of the British armed services put together. Fayetteville is effectively a garrison city, with every business geared up for the military. The troops are the ones with the money and the desire to burn it. Like them, in all the times I'd been there, I'd never felt the need to venture out of the city limits. The 401 was a wide, single carriageway. I drove through a few small towns which would have made great locations for 1950s films, or, better still, could have done with a couple of £1,000 to put them out of their misery, before the area started to open up into cornfields and grassland. Houses and small industrial units dotted the route, alongside open barns filled with tractors and other agricultural gear. At every few miles, in case people needed reminding that they were in the boonies, I came across a roadkill, a mess of blood and fur as flat as a pancake in the middle of the blacktop. I knew I was getting near when I hit the Cape Fear River. The water was about 300 metres across at this point, getting wider as it got closer to the sea, and sure enough I passed the City of Fayetteville sign before long, and kept my eyes peeled for anything directing me to Fort Bragg. Bragg Boulevard was a wide dual carriageway with a grass central reservation. But as I passed rows of car showrooms with new 4x4s and sports cars under miles of red, white and blue bunting, it changed back to two lanes. The buildings on either side were mainly one-story breeze block warehouses behind a shopfront. Korean pawn shops and tailors jostled with Vietnamese restaurants and takeaways, representing a weird chronicle of all the conflicts the USA had ever been involved in. They just needed an Iraqi kebab stall to complete the set. I was beginning to see the kind of outlets I'd come here to find. Neon signs and posters announced boot shining specialists, tattoo artists, and gun shops. Test fire before you buy. We have our own range. On every sidewalk, young men and women strode around in smartly pressed BDUs, combat uniform, and very short haircuts. The men usually had a white wool with a little lump on top. It felt very strange to see uniformed soldiers on the streets without a weapon and not on patrol. The terrorist situation in Europe meant that off-duty soldiers were forbidden to walk around in uniform. They'd just be ready-made targets. I drove on base and got my bearings. American military installations aren't like European ones, which resemble World War II prisoner of war camps, again because of the terrorist threat. This place was open and sprawling, with vehicle pools and groups of men and women on route marches, singing cadence, their unit flag carried proudly at the head of the column. I couldn't remember the name of the road I wanted, but I followed my nose, driving along roads with buildings on each side which looked more like smart apartments than barrack rooms. I found it. Yadkin. A long road that came out of the base and moved into the city area. There had been quite a bit of building since my last visit in the late 80s. Roads coming off the main drag had names like Desert Storm Boulevard, or Just Cause Road. I wondered if the firm would ever get round to naming thoroughfares after its operations. If so, they'd have to be called things like Blackmail Lane, or Stitch Them Up Big Time Street. I carried on along Yadkin, until it took me off base. Past Kim's number one sewing, Susie J's, I wasn't too sure what service she was offering, and whole blocks of military supply shops. There was one I remembered, called U.S. Cavalry. It had been a complete department store for the start-your-own-war nut. Glass counters displaying sharp, pointy things, racks of BDUs, military T-shirts and combat helmets, rows and rows of boots, and shelves of posters and books with such politically correct titles as Ragnar's Big Book of Homemade Weapons and The Advanced Anarchist Arsenal. Recipes for improvised incendiaries and explosives. Always good for that last-minute Christmas present. I drove past shopfronts displaying murals of airborne assaults. One had a giant poster of John Wayne in uniform in the window. After another mile, I saw the store I wanted and drove into the car park. Jim's was the same size as a small superstore. The front had a wooden ranch look about it, but the rest was whitewashed breeze block. The front windows looked almost cottagey from a distance, with lots of little square panes. But as you got nearer, you could see the panes were just white painted bars behind the thick plate glass. And the anti-ram barriers one-third of the way up the windows weren't there to tie your horse up to either. Through the foyer I could see keyboards, VCRs, and rows of TV screens all showing Jerry Springer. It was to the left of all that, however, a place where there were no windows at all, that they kept what I'd come here for. I walked onto a small veranda where a large red sign warned me, "Before entry, weapons will be unloaded. Actions opened, and thank you for not smoking." The inside of Jim's gunnery was L-shaped. To my right was a pawn shop. The rest disappeared around the corner to my left, past a counter selling magazines and sweets. Opposite was a small shop within a shop, selling jewellery. The place smelled more like a department store than a pawn shop. It was very clean, with a polished tiled floor. I turned left, towards a series of glass display cases all containing pistols, hundreds of them, and behind them, in wall racks, rifles, with something to suit every taste, from bolt action to assault. After I picked up a wire basket, I was greeted by a very well-fed white guy in his mid-30s, wearing a green polo shirt with Jim's logo on it, a Glock 45 in a pancake holster on his belt, and a big smile. "Hi, how are you today?" In my bad American, I replied, "I'm good. How are you?" I wasn't worried. The transient military population made it a lot easier to get away with a dodgy accent. Besides, they'd only think I was Australian. Americans always do. "I'm good, sir. Is there anything I can do for you today?" "Just having a look round, thanks." He beamed. "If you need anything, just holler." Heading towards the weapons counter, I passed shelves, stacked supermarket fashion with boxes of ammunition and everything for the hunting man. Even down to barber jackets and shooting sticks, which surprisingly didn't look out of place. Anti-mugging sprays hung from racks. I couldn't decide whether to have the CS gas or the pepper spray, so in the end I put both in my basket. The footwear section sold camouflaged Gore-Tex boots and an assortment of Wellingtons and leather footgear. What I wanted, and eventually found, was a normal pair of high-leg assault boots, a mixture of cross-trainer and boot. The Gore-Tex and Go-Faster boots were all well and good, but I could never really be bothered with trying to keep my feet dry. Once they were wet, which they would be tonight, that was it. I just got on with it. I didn't bother to try the boots on. It wasn't as if I was going to be tabbing for 6 days across the Appalachians. I got them in a size 10. I was size 9, but remembered from a very painful few days in a pair of new U.S.